Hi everybody, it's Gershom Aitchison from Education Incorporated. Today I'm in the studio with Claire York, who's an educational psychologist. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. And would you mind sharing a little bit who you are and what you do?
My road to being an educational psychologist started a while ago. I was a teacher for a good few years and really enjoyed that. I worked predominantly with younger children. And then following main class teaching, I did some remedial and some learning support. And then from there decided, okay, I want to stay within the educational field, but move out in different directions. And that's when I studied further and became an educational psychologist. So that's the brief route of how it went. Within the educational realm of psychology, I decided that because I joined it rather late, I would try and specialize in one area, and I made that accommodation and assessments in general. So to try and up my game, I did my doctorate in accommodations in an IEB setting and have really enjoyed working in that area. So that is the area in which we've met, worked at your school in that.
It's been quite a few years now.
It has. Yeah. Yes, it has.
That's what we're going to have a conversation about today, and that is accommodations or concessions. Is there a difference between the two in terms of the terminology?
Quite recently, the Department of Education have named what we used to call exemption session.
Okay.
So it's exemption/concessions for us in terms of getting used to that.
Okay.
So accommodations is your general term,
right.
And concessions
kind of
pertains. Well, that pertains to the exemptions, the concession name is now.
I've always been interested. You get educational psychologists, counseling psychologists, clinical psychologists. Where do educational psychologists fit into this realm of supporting children emotionally? And if I do understand it correctly, being a teacher is you have to have teaching hours and experience and qualifications to become an educational psychologist, if I'm not mistaken.
It's not an absolute prerequisite, as I understand it. You get educational psychologists coming in from a social working
right.
background. But, you know, it prerequisites for degrees change. So that's as I know it.
Okay.
For me, the background of education and working in a classroom and working in learning support was invaluable in terms of going into the accommodation realm and having a full understanding of barriers to learning and a broader spectrum than just accommodations as to how support may go. So counseling psychologists definitely assess, and they are doing accommodations as well as educational psychologists.
Oh, that's interesting. I thought it was only the realm of educational psychologists who could apply for that.
Mm-mm. No, okay. Others can do it. They're also trained in the testing, as are the clinical psychologists, but clinicals seem to veer to a different area in terms of the psychology basket.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. One of the words that you just brought up was barriers to learning.
Mm.
Can we talk a little bit about what those barriers might be and why we call them barriers to learning as opposed to kids not being able to learn, for example? Barriers feel like they are something that can be overcome or accommodated for, as it were.
There's quite a broad spectrum in terms of your barriers to learning. So typically in a school, you think of them as your learning disorders, whereas you can also include your physical barriers to learning that are not maybe as often thought of. Children who maybe have only one arm, an amputee or a traumatic brain injury, those are also considered your barriers to learning.
I remember in our experience, in terms of the physical side of things, eyesight has been one of those physical barriers to learning where we've had to have, and the IEB has been very good in printing A3 examinations and allowing magnifying glasses and things like that.
That's
in the examination.
Right. So in terms of visual, obviously that is a barrier to learning that needs focus specifically on it.
Yeah.
There are general accommodations that pertain to the visual. So as you mentioned, that one of them would be the enlarged font.
Yes.
The enlarged to typically font S size 18.
Yeah.
And then there's also the accommodation for when they are doing their visual literacy.
Right.
And can't see that as well as they need to. So then that is adapted for them. They are given a different task or a different run-up to the task.
And yeah. I can imagine that colorblindness might be the other.
Yes, colorblindness is there, and you can have an assistant to tell you what the colors are in your maths or in your geography, typically, is where it comes up.
Right. In a practical with life sciences or chemistry, asking for colors of solutions might also be quite interesting.
Again, you know, in that aspect, you would need your practical assistant to guide you.
So one of the things that I'd like to do is just go through some of the terminology and concepts. And, you know, we talk about a lot of the barriers to learning being on continuums.
Mm.
As an example, I have parents having a conversation with me saying, my child has dyslexia. And I say to them, it's not you have it or not. It's on a continuum. Mm. And because our brains are all wired uniquely, we have different ways of expressing what that might look like. Mm. And the same with autism, the same with dyscalculia, dysgraphia, for example. So can we talk a little bit about what those continuums or spectrums look like? Are they synonymous with each other, or how do you guys view this?
So I would take up on the dyslexia part, first of all, because that is what we're seeing as a psychologist assessing for accommodations. We're seeing more and more of that. I think sometimes if you track back, children are given an identification of dyslexia very early on, sometimes without chance for response to intervention. So when they identified as dyslexic without having had the benefit of possibly speech therapy or remedial therapy, sometimes it's given a higher profile than maybe it needs to be given for that child. And you see as they move along and they work through their supportive interventions, sometimes that label of dyslexia is no longer as relevant. But, you know, obviously for children who are definitely dyslexic, we know that dyslexia is for life. Mm. And for that reason, I think it would be sounder to look at a full battery of assessments and not rely on just a single screening to give that diagnosis, so that you can see the full range and see where they are positioning on that level or at what risk ratio they are for dyslexia. So I think that's something that's becoming, from my perspective, from my personal assessment view, is becoming more and more of a factor that needs to be sometimes re-looked at, explained to parents that, as you say, whilst dyslexia is for life, is it actually dyslexia or is it a learning barrier? Where do we position with that? And if you are looking at dyslexia, at what rate and at what level is that dyslexia? Is it severe or is it mild? And that big decision needs to be taken in cognizance of more than just a single screening.
You've touched on something which I feel quite strongly about, and so does Jax, and that is once we have the label, we stop building the skills because we've got an excuse not to do it.
Mm.
For example, reading. Kids with dyslexia say, I can't read. You can learn to read. It's a mechanical process. It's just very difficult, and it requires a lot of energy for you to do so. Just because you might get an accommodation of a reader during the exam as you go into the FET phase of your schooling, as an adult, you're still required to read. And yes, you can get a lot of text-to-speech and vice versa, but it doesn't mean that you can't read. It just means it's a lot more difficult. And it's quite disheartening to see kids giving up on learning those skills because they are being told that they can't. Is any truth in that thought process?
I think a true dyslexic will maybe plateau in the level that they can read and the fluency with which they can read. But typically, children sometimes stop, as you say, if given the label before
the plateau has
been reached. And that's always the caution in saying dyslexic, therefore don't try anymore.
Sure.
So, you know, my take would be reading is a skill.
Mm.
And if you have mastered parts of it, if you're good at word reading or you may be good at the decoding, try and run with your strength and develop it as far as you can, given that skills can sometimes be improved with good practice and interventions.
Sure.
So, yeah, I would go with you that sometimes children with the label of dyslexia opt out earlier than necessary.
Yeah.
But on the other side, there are some children that haven't been diagnosed as dyslexic and have really experienced huge difficulties that do need the clarification of where they are in the dyslexic rating.
Their academic identity is quite much, is very much involved in this process, and we've got a balance between pushing hard and still learning, but not making it so hard that it starts eroding the academic self-confidence, the academic identity.
Yes, I think realizing the implications of the barrier and their actual level.
Sure. I've often found working with kids with dyslexia, and we're using this as an example, so we're just going to keep going down this rabbit hole, is that it's not like kids with ADHD who can take a pill, which helps them calm their minds, and then they can do the work and build the skills. Dyslexia cannot be solved by a pill. So it's sitting down with them saying, right, if spelling's a difficulty and you're getting anxious about that, rather use a pictographic way of studying, for example, or use an auditory process of studying. Their memories are often very good because they've learned to memorize words instead of decoding words to read, for an example.
Right.
And teaching them what those strengths are and learning to play around that. And then finding in classrooms how to give them the same access to the information that other kids have just from reading.
You touched on the access, and I think that's where accommodations do come in. They're not a magic wand. They don't dispel all difficulty.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's not fully understood. But with accommodation, a poor reader should be able to access the curriculum and should be able to access the exam. And that's, I think, the crux of it. And they're often termed access arrangements in other countries.
I like that because it's less threatening than, you know, than other terminology, for example, accommodations or exemptions. Often I've had to have the conversation with a child where I've had the conversation with the parents and I'm saying, please allow me the opportunity to talk to the child and guide them through this process. And I'll say to them, I'm asking for accommodations on this, not because I think you're stupid. You're smart. You are in a mainstream school. But if you're studying at 100% and you're getting 60% and another child who's studying at 100% gets 80%, the accommodations are to give you the access for that 20% to make it fair, the accommodations fair for you, and make sure that you are being able to demonstrate your knowledge and skills at the same level as somebody who doesn't have those barriers.
My take on accommodations is that it allows the child to work to their optimal level.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that by giving an accommodation, you're going to be able to perform at the same level as a child with a totally different profile.
Interesting, yeah.
So it's to be able to do your best, not to be able to take away all the stress and all the difficulties that you're experiencing. It's rather to allow you to work to your potential, not taking in mind other children's potential.
And your parents' expectations of your potential. Which is often one of the conversations we have to have. You will do physics, you will do core maths, and the child's potential is not necessarily, they may pass that, but they're certainly not going to get A's. And I just use that because it is the most common theme.
Do a science, it opens doors.
Yes.
Not
to
always.
Pain and misery, not always, exactly. And it's funny because they are very, very important subjects. But because they're important, people often are asking fishes to climb trees and they can't do that. So we've spoken about dyslexia. Let's talk a little bit about dyscalculia and dysgraphia, because dyslexia is a term that's been around for a long time. Dyscalculia and dysgraphia, and I don't know if there's any that fall within the same kind of space, they seem to be in the same vein, but a further part of the same family as dyslexia. Am I understanding this correctly?
Well, my take on dyscalculia is that it's profound difficulties with maths that don't go away despite good teaching, diligent approach, learning support.
Okay.
So similar in its manifestation to dyslexia, but obviously the maths version of it. And again, in South Africa, we have the maths literacy as a bit of a lifeline for maths, and that catches some of the children that would possibly be termed mildly dyscalculic.
Yeah. And the dysgraphia?
Dysgraphia, in terms of accommodation, it manifests predominantly in the written sphere.
Okay.
So can start with the big motoric difficulties and then the fine motor difficulties. And as I say, at the high school level, where we're looking at accommodations, would present typically as difficulties in writing. So not just untidy writing, but also looking at the presentation, the ability to space, that would all compromise the expression of intellect if they can't get it down.
Yeah. I think what a lot of people might misunderstand about assessment is that it's not just assessing knowledge, it's assessing knowledge under a timed condition. So while some people with dyslexia or dysgraphia might still be able to write well or to be able to read well, it takes them a lot longer and a lot more. There's a lot more of a mental cost to doing so, which then doesn't allow them to finish the papers in time and to actually demonstrate their knowledge under their time constraint. Is that why often time is a big part of the process, giving more time to finish assessment?
Time is a huge factor in accommodations, and it is the one accommodation that is most commonly given when you look at research. But for some children with profound barriers to learning, their skills don't improve with time.
Yeah.
So that's why there are separate, sometimes a need for separate accommodations. So, you know, that is.
So can I also just ask about the concept that we are talking about in accommodations is in a mainstream setting. So kids who have barriers to learning, and if given accommodations or exemptions or concessions, are able to, in a mainstream school, still be able to access information and demonstrate their skills and knowledge at the end of the day through assessment. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about special needs or remedial kids.
Remedial children do sometimes use accommodations, okay, and are able to get through their senior leaving certificate.
Okay.
Doesn't discount them. Sometimes they write a different board of examination.
Okay.
And they choose their subjects differently.
Based on their strengths and
On their strengths. There's also an endorsed matriculation that children to take less subjects and pass at a late. So there are those areas that allow children to still get to the end of the grade 12.
Claire, I'm sitting here with a list of accommodations that the IEB can offer. And as a school and as a psychologist, you make recommendations based on the assessments that you've done. And the first one is adapted examination papers for visually impaired. I'm assuming that would be the A3, 18 font, etc.
There is a separate accommodation, and it's not specific only to IEB. You would find it in some of the other boards as well, examination boards.
Yes.
So there's a separate accommodation called enlarged font.
Okay.
And then the adapted papers would be more honing in on the children that need visual literacy rehashed for them. Well, that's actually not a good word.
Okay.
That would
reframed?
That would need the visual literacy reframed.
Then we've got additional time, which we have covered. It's given for a lot of accommodations.
It is given for a lot of accommodations. And as I mentioned, it is the most frequently given.
Okay.
It's also the most contentious because it can give a child an advantage. And that is not the purpose of accommodations.
Yeah.
So typically with additional time, it's given in increments of 5, 10 and 15 minutes with a new look at being able to give more time for severe visual and hearing difficulties and some others, which are itemized and listed by the department and also by the examination boards like the IEB and Sakai.
And that's generally 5, 10 or 15 minutes per hour of an exam paper.
Mm.
So if a child was writing a 3-hour exam paper, they would get at most 45 minutes, so they'd be able to write for 3 hours and 45 minutes.
That's right, Gisham. That's how it's given.
Braille examination papers, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. Braille word processor, that's pretty self-explanatory for kids who are blind to be able to type. Then we've got computer concessions, which in my mind is one of the biggest contentions. I think every teenager would love that. And I think they deliberately start writing untidily so that they can get a computer accommodation.
For untidy handwriting, the first look at accommodations would be, do they need a handwriting sticker whereby the marker is going to take the time to decipher what they've written?
Right.
So that would be your first take for untidy writing. If it is beyond what a handwriting sticker would be able to accommodate and have in their scope, then you start looking at a computer. And you'd also look at a computer sometimes for physical barriers.
Mm.
And you would also look at a computer where their work rate is just not functional when they're handwriting but is functional when they are typing or on the computer. So again, the computer isn't given to allow an unfair advantage.
So that's the part when we're doing the applications to, in my case, the IEB, where we have the handwriting samples and they're always done. There's always a time at the bottom of them.
That's
and the number of words. So it's word rate, and the same with the computer. And also looking at the mistakes made in those spaces as well.
That's right. To try and look at the overview of it. They're starting to use the DASH as an assessment tool, which gives you a standard score for that, and that's also helpful.
Sure, it gives you a baseline.
It does.
We've spoken about enlarged font. There's endorsed NSC, which you've spoken about and mentioned. Exemption from first additional language. Now, this is one that I think most Joburg kids who are first language English speakers would love, and that's to be exempt from Afrikaans. And what is interesting is that this year, the CAT for IEB the Afrikaans CAT was based on the importance of first additional language being bilingual, Afrikaans being 100 years old. And I think kids rob themselves of the understanding that learning a first additional language is a very different neurological process.
I think they often see getting exemption from Afrikaans or concession from Afrikaans, as it's now termed, as a way out of taking that language. It maybe requires more effort than some of the other subjects, and they want to swap it out. But that is not the purpose of exemptions.
It's not to make it easier. Yeah.
Exemption is given when a child has a significant learning disorder, such as severe dyslexia.
Sure.
You're also given it for a traumatic brain injury sometimes, and they're listed in the forms so that you can sort of taper your expectations of getting a first additional language.
So not just because I don't like Afrikaans, I'm never going to use it. I'm an English speaker and it's difficult.
Exactly. Or it's pulling down my average marks.
Yeah.
So no, that's not the purpose of an exemption.
Exemption, mathematics or mathematical literacy. Now that's something I've seen for the first time this year.
Okay.
And was quite surprised. I don't know. Because it affects a lot of subjects. You can't take geography if you can't do maths. You can't take business studies or economics or physics or life science even, because there's maths in so much of what we're doing. It's like saying exemption from reading anything or comprehending anything.
I agree. The use of maths is way beyond just the subject. So I think for mathematics, why you maybe haven't seen it as often as wanting exemption from first additional language is that maths literacy offers a lifeline for children who are weak at maths but sure, still can cope with the level of it. Maths exemption is given when there is a severe case of dyscalculia typically.
Yeah.
And despite huge supportive interventions, the child has just not been able to grasp the fundamentals of maths. And then it's applied for them.
One of the delicacies around this for us as teachers is when making a recommendation is it a short-term memory issue where the kid is able to grasp, but it's kind of got a goldfish memory. The child has a goldfish memory that the next day it's all gone and you have to start again. It's difficult for us as teachers to understand when a child has dyscalculia and when it might be a memory problem. Is that a fair statement to look at?
Well, I think you've touched on the importance of working memory, and that would be the visual and the auditory. That does definitely impact learning across the board. So it may hinder them, but I don't think it'll be the single cause of not being able to do maths at all.
Handwriting we've spoken about. Here's an interesting one, medication or food intake.
That's primarily for the children such as your diabetics that need time out to be able to take food or to test. The medication intake has been used primarily by the children that are diabetics, also sometimes have it for epilepsy and for other difficulties that are needed to be dealt with during the process of writing, where they need to take medication or they take food. Typically, not the same as a rest break.
I've seen it indicated for a case with a child who had a severe eating disorder and was required to eat regularly to make sure that the habit of that eating disorder wasn't reinforced, and that it was seen as well, because that's more a psychological element rather than a physical yet.
But if they need their food on a regular basis, yeah, hourly intake, yes, then that would come in there.
Practical assistant.
That's to ensure that the learner can get through the examination without physically needing someone to help them. So you would only give it for children that need help, possibly in getting to the exam and in turning pages and in working with science experiments. That's where I've seen it.
Prompter?
The prompter is typically used by children with attention difficulties, and that is having somebody that will refocus them, so redirect their attention to writing them.
And then we've got a reader and a scribe. And I think I'd like to discuss those two together, because often they go hand in hand.
Separate accommodations. So the reader is for the children that are struggling with reading, struggling sometimes with the mechanics of reading, and then struggling with the time. That's where it would come in.
And then the scribe?
The scribe is for the child where the verbal expression is typically higher than the written expression, and you want them to be able to perform to potential. And so it would come in typically there.
We've seen it as a combination. I think they call it an amanuensis.
That word was used. It's no longer itemized like that. Okay. Yeah, it's put in separate.
Where we saw this with kids with dyslexia specifically, where they needed a reader,
mm-hmm.
And because of the spelling being so bad and causing so much anxiety when being able to write, that they just have a reader and a scribe being able to accommodate them through that process.
I think you often find a scribe comes with a need to have their spelling accommodated, but it wouldn't be a single reason, because you do have a spelling accommodation.
Right.
But what is interesting is, just as you've touched on, children with poor spelling sometimes dumb down what they write because they restrict their written content to words that they can spell. And so in that case, a scribe would possibly be a better accommodation.
Because they're verbally able to express themselves and articulate
exactly
better than paper, right?
You typically see a good verbal expression score, a VCI score, good vocab coming through, good reasoning skills coming through verbally that aren't reflected in their written work.
We have rephrased examination papers.
That's been there a while to accommodate children with hearing difficulties, so that have profound hearing loss, and as a result of that would possibly find that their language development is compromised.
Okay.
And so for that reason, they rephrase the paper.
Rest breaks, as opposed to the medication or food intake that we've discussed?
So rest breaks are commonly asked for by children that are experiencing high levels of anxiety. So they feel that they need to step away from their desk, have the clock stopped in order for them to regain composure and then get back to it. Also for children with scoliosis, I've come across that, where they need to actually be able to move to release the tension that they're experiencing from a muscular point of view. So those are the ones that I've assessed and worked with.
That's fascinating. Specific equipment.
That's for children that have barriers to learning that don't fall possibly in the category that has already been discussed, or that are spin-offs. So I've worked with children that want noise-cancelling headphones or earplugs. They want specific cushions to sit on, specific lights to be able to make it easier for them to see. So that's the type of other accommodations that I have experienced.
And then separate venue, which often goes hand in hand with things like a reader or a scribe, where they have to be in a separate venue one-on-one. What is the purpose of a separate venue?
So a separate venue is no longer guaranteed to be just you in a room, just the child in a room. It's a separate venue or a smaller venue to be more realistic. So you have children that are working on portals that will be grouped together, all having the benefit of a reader via the portal.
Sure.
Again, other children that typically need it are your ADHD candidates that feel they would work better with less distractions.
Sure.
And yeah, it's separate venues, quite a contentious issue in schools, just from resource perspective in terms of physical resource. Where do we put all these children? And human resource in terms of staffing all the separate venues. So I think the fact that it's been acknowledged that it may be a smaller venue and not a separate venue has been well accepted.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that has also been contentious for us. So computers and the separate venues and exemption from Afrikaans are three biggest bugbears, because the kids want to use computers. It's easier for them. They want to be exempt from Afrikaans and a separate venue because it just feels nicer to be in your own little cocoon working. And obviously for kids that have readers or scribes or need to articulate that would distract other students, then we would find a separate venue. But as you say, it's very difficult to find the manpower. Also, the IEB requires a camera for us to be able to monitor the examination centers. And this is one of the things I spoke to the IEB about, and that was, what is the intention behind it? And coming to the understanding that it was to take a child out of a 300 or 100 room size room where kids are writing an exam, and you've got three invigilators walking up and down, to a smaller space where they are less distracted. So we do have venues now that if a kid is needing to be not be distracted, that we put them facing a wall, that they're not seeing other, not physically seeing other learners, but there might be three or four or five learners in that one room where they're not seeing each other, but it fulfills that accommodation as well.
For me, it's always trying to make it possible for the child within their own profile to work to potential.
Yeah.
So that's why I think a smaller venue and the spin-offs that you are putting in for that in terms of placement in the room would work well. That would be my personal take, as long as the child is being able to work to their full potential.
Claire, that's a great segue to have a conversation around some of the difficulties that we face within our professional opinion, and that is of a headmaster, an academic custodian, as it were, and an educational psychologist who is looking at a child's educational profile within that academic environment, and that of the parents' expectations. Because a parent will always have very, very good expectations, or should have good expectations of their child. But does it meet what is physically possible or mentally possible? And sometimes those expectations might be, my child needs a bit of a free ride. And one of the questions I always have for guys doing the work that you are is, how do you manage parents whose expectation is accommodations? You get a sense that this is about making my child's life easier, for example. Or when you're giving the feedback on the reports and the child thinks this is a straight A student, and you're going, your child is a solid C student, and with the accommodations, that's the potential that we should be working towards.
I think in terms of managing parents and their understanding, first of all, on the accommodation process, that is something that often requires discussion. And possibly one of the things that repeatedly comes up is that we all want your child to work to full capacity.
Yeah.
And the numbers on the intellectual score rate and on the academic score rates doesn't always mean the ceiling for them. We have lots of times where a child will exceed that. But again, to temper it with, is the child doing their best? Have they got good support? Is the parent supportive, or are they actually being detrimental to the child reaching their potential? So I think that would be my starting point, is to see it as a whole and not to see it, the accommodation all hanging on the results from a psychologist, but to make it clear that it's looked at in a wider viewpoint than just that. So how the child is performing at school, are they reaching their potential there? What is the work ethic like?
Yeah, are they motivated? Are they disciplined?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's the work ethic like? What are your teacher comments like? Not just trying to squeeze it all into just one psychoed test battery.
What do you see the school's role in this process? A lot of parents believe that once the psyched has done the assessment, that those accommodations will happen and that's in place. And a lot of the conversation I have to have with them is that half the report, the other half of the application is evidence from the school, the teachers that are working, that needs to be endorsed by the schools because we are working with the child all the time. What is your view on the school's role in this process?
Well, I see it as fundamental. It's never just the profile that's generated by the psychologist in the psychoed. It's always looked at in a broader context, and that is predominantly the school for a learner. Mm. So quite rightly so, the teacher should have input. The reports will guide, as will previous reports. Is this a trend that has been trend of performance that's been around for several years, or is it just a flash in the pan bad mark? So absolutely, it's looked at it more than just being done and dusted once you've had the psychoed report done.
How do you manage in your assessments if it is clear that a child is dumbing it down, trying to underplay their ability? Does that ever happen, or are there checks and balances in place within those assessments that you can see? Is the process fallible or infallible? That's basically what I'm asking.
I think you always have to be aware of weaknesses in an assessment area. But there definitely are ways to help determine if a child is manipulating. And for that reason, you'll see several examination boards getting a child to sign that they will not manipulate the results to try and gain the accommodation that they feel they want. Mm. So that is done in terms of the child taking responsibility for working honestly. Also, parents maybe underestimate the child's ability to read where they need to be manipulating if they want to get the outcome that they desire. It's more than just writing a spelling test. You look at it in a greater context. You look at what the spelling's like previously. You look at it in terms of a history as well. So using that simple example, I think sometimes they're not aware of the complexity of an assessment battery and the fact that it is not just always hinged on a single solitary test.
And I think what you've just touched on within a context, and I think the school plays the role of context as well, because mm-hmm. you will see a child typically for a day or two while you're doing the assessment. The teachers are seeing the child for 6-7 hours a day.
Absolutely.
And understand the context within which the kid operates and what their potential might be based on that.
Absolutely. That's why it can never hang simply on a psychoed result.
Yeah. Claire, we've had a very interesting deep dive into a lot of the accommodations, a lot of the specifics, and I'm quite sure that it takes more than just one podcast to get a good sense of all of this. The purpose of this podcast was to give a general idea to our communities about what accommodations is, dispel some of the myths and legends around it, so they understand that it is a process, it's a scientific process, and it's done within the context of a school for the child's benefit to help them achieve their potential. And that potential can be variable depending on their circumstances, attitude, the motivation, etc. What I'd like to do is just have a look at accommodations globally. South Africa is sitting at about 10% within the IAB space, and I'm fully aware that one of the limitations of accommodation globally is that generally the more affluent populations have access to it, where the less affluent populations don't necessarily get the accommodations that they are worthwhile, and that's obviously what the wealth gap promotes within education. But within South Africa, we're sitting at about 10%. And just looking globally at the United States, which has a lot of data around accommodations, they're sitting at about 15%. The United Kingdom is sitting at about 20%. Australia is the highest at 25 to 27% of their kids with accommodations. And New Zealand is very similar to South Africa in that they focus primarily on the assessment accommodations, and they're sitting at about 8 to 12% of secondary students estimated. So it looks like South Africa is on the more conservative side of things, but well within line with what's happening globally with supporting our students with accommodations.
Yes, I think in terms of accommodation ideas, South Africa has learnt a lot from abroad, but our context is different, as you've touched on. So it's never a case of just importing ideas straight and implementing them. It always has to be looked at against our context.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of affordability, that is something that creeps in to accommodation applications. But it's something that is also starting to be addressed. Certain universities are doing accommodation assessments to assist children. You're also having school psychologists stepping in and taking the cost away because it's absorbed.
That's one of the barriers. Yeah.
It's absorbed. So, yes, we've certainly learnt from accommodations overseas. We've learnt a great deal, but need to apply them within South Africa's specific needs and context.
One of the things that has become a global trend based on recent research is that there is an increase in accommodations. And one would always say it might be because of COVID, but often in this case, it's more about more understanding, more accessibility to those accommodations. And specifically on the autism spectrum disorders, there seems to have been an increase in that space.
Yes, I think we are far more aware of autism and the sliding scales of it. And obviously, with greater knowledge, you can accommodate it more effectively.
From our discussion, Claire, it seems that most countries are offering academic concessions, and it's about extra time, accessibility, the child reaching their potential, as it were. But one of the key factors is that there needs to be a history built up, and documentation is the key part to this because it creates better context and understanding the child's potential and growth and where they might reach that plateau, as you're talking about. What would your advice be to parents who are starting this journey? What would you like to say to them so that the process is easier for them and that they can maximize what they can do to help their children?
Well, I think often the process starts in the primary schools. And there, in terms of accommodations, I would swing to the side of putting supportive interventions beyond accommodations in place, first of all, so that the parents understand that not every barrier to learning can just be dispelled with an accommodation. That often that you need your therapies, your speech therapies, your OT therapies to precede that. And then in terms of being ready for should you need an accommodation that would be formally granted slightly later, then you need your paper trail. So any therapies that you've had, you would keep your reports, you would keep your documentation, should it be medical, so that you have that background history to support the need, the genuine need for an accommodation later on.
We always say to the students, what we're giving you is a toolbox. It's important that you learn to use the tools in those toolboxes so that you can get the most out of them. And that often it is at their discretion when and how they would like to use those accommodations. We have students who do not use a scribe for mathematics. They find it too difficult. Even if they've got a reader and a scribe available to them in Afrikaans, because they can't speak as well and pronounce as well, they find it easier for them to do their own Afrikaans and use the extra time. And I think that's important. Is there any advice to the students when it comes to accommodations and how they can maximize the use of it and the benefit of it once it's been given to them?
I would emphasize that accommodations aren't always the fix-all. So they would be assisting them, but that doesn't preclude the student from needing to put the hard yards in. So they would still need to prepare for exams. They would still need to be ready for their daily lessons to get the most out of it.
Sure.
It's not a cop-out for good learning procedures that would go before the accommodations or along with the accommodations.
Claire, thank you very much for your valuable time that you've spent today in our studio and sharing your depths of knowledge and wisdom with us. We as a school value your input. I know the students that we have sent to you have always come out better off than when we sent them, and accommodations have always been spot on. So thank you very much for that, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you. It's good to be involved with your school.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.